KALW.
You know, I was just told that they hadn't thought about hiring negresses yet.
Black women journalists have had to face criticism and jump over many hurdles to be seen and taken seriously.
I told every agent that I had, if they ever come to you and say something about my hair, I promise you that's the last day I'm gonna be on air.
We'll explore what it means to be a Black woman on the air today, and we'll go back in time to hear what it was like in the past with a Bay Area broadcasting pioneer.
I always thought a lot about the people who paid forward for me. So whatever was happening because some student had his head busted open, some person been pushed off a bus.
Black Women in Journalism with icon Belva Davis and Jamel Hill. It's an episode from the Stoop podcast, Black on Air, today on Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. The pen, the microphone, the camera, they're all powerful tools that people in media use to get our attention. But for Black women journalists, getting a hold of that power and keeping it, it's been a tough path to navigate. From how we sound, to what we look like, to how our hair is done, to how we say things, Black women have had to face scrutiny and flat-out racism at times. Today, we're presenting an episode of the Stoop podcast, hosted by me and Lila Day, and we're exploring the challenges Black women have had to face to make it in media. Here's the episode, Black on Air.
An ABC News brief brought to you by Reuniti Spumante. Now from Washington, Carol Simpson.
Good evening. Roger Patterson, the American Nicaragua said was killed last month while fighting along.
Entered the 1979 season with the same goal, to enter their name on the passport to Pasadena.
Oh, she is being called a little hero, a five-year-old Long Island girl.
Well, Richard, nothing's going to keep students away from Chicago's Providence St. Mel High School today. The students at the all-black inner-city school had been told their school would close because the Chicago Archdiocese had run out of money. But the students fought to keep St. Mel open to prove they're good.
Carol Simpson, Jane Kennedy, Carol Jenkins, and Lila, we know that last voice. Oprah.
Go Opes.
Go Opes. But let's talk about getting into this line of work, because Lila, it's not an easy field to be in. Not to mention, it's a pretty lonely field for Black women.
Yeah, there's this statistic. In 2018, Black women made up just 3.4% of U.S. newsrooms. And since it's Black History Month all year long on The Stoop, we wanted to take some time to celebrate where we've been, where we're at, and where we're going.
Right. So let's start with where we've been. And that's where this woman comes in.
My name is Belva Davis, and I consider myself a journalist even to today.
So Belva Davis was the first Black woman to become a TV reporter on the West Coast in the 60s.
She covered the Berkeley riots of the free speech movement. She covered the Black Panthers, the Jonestown massacre.
Good evening and welcome once again to A Closer Look. I'm Belva Davis. Tonight we'll report on some of the background behind the People's Temple, including the...
And she covered the George Moscone and Harvey Milk assassinations, the AIDS and crack epidemics. She is an icon.
I think one never really can get over the idea once it's in your head that you're a journalist.
So back in the 50s, when Belva first started, there were few places that Black journalists could work. I mean, most of them worked in Black media. And Belva started as a writer at Jet Magazine.
And then after the 1964 Civil Rights Act, she moved into radio. She was reporting for KSAN in San Francisco. And she remembers going for her first job.
After many, many interviews, and some of them pretty insulting, that I would think I should even be interviewed. Well, the one I quote all the time, I don't want to beat up on these people forever in life. It was so many years ago, but, you know, that in one station, you know, I was just told that they hadn't thought about hiring negresses yet. But if they ever really wanted to pursue a negress, they would certainly get in touch with me first because I'd been on radio. And then the guy didn't know that he was being insulting. And not until I wrote a book. I think that he really knew that how much that had hurt.
Not hiring Negresses, she said. She said it. They said it.
I know. They said it. Whew. So Belleville went from print to radio, and her next step was going to work as a reporter in television.
The first day, I think, I was just too petrified or really trying to let my reality catch up with my mental state.
So most of her crew was white and male, and she remembers how awkward that was back in the day when people would catch a glimpse of her and her team on the streets reporting.
There was the discomfort of even, you know, walking down the street with me. I tried to actually bring stories to the newsroom, and I also tried to get assigned to the most difficult stories that I could, so that I could get over the period of having to, prove myself. I always thought a lot about the people who paid forward for me. So whatever was happening because some student had his head busted open, some person had been pushed off a bus, some people had marched miles for me to get where I was. And I thought of them as paying my way. So it wasn't just me. So it was my obligation that if they reflected on it and there was one person they'd impacted, that I recognized that. So I don't think that I ever felt real anger. I kept trying to figure out, how do I make people who've given up so much just feel at least that I'm trying? Whether I make a difference or not, I'm trying. And I'm trying for you and me.
So Belva said this thing, and it sticks with me, Hannah. It's this idea of paying it forward. And I gotta say, that's what I was told to do. And I think that's what a lot of us were told to do. But damn, that's a job.
I mean, yes, we talk a lot about mentorship. And it's something that just comes with the territory in this field, right? Like, you want to lift other young journalists of color up. And that's just what we do. It's a big part of what we do. To get more people on board.
Because the more of us that are on the air, the more we get to share our stories and share our voices. I mean, like this voice.
Well, so the Japanese asked Trump to visit this month because they wanted him to be the first state guest to meet with Emperor Naruhito, who ascended to the throne this month.
Yes, we know who that is. That's Aisha Roscoe from NPR.
Yep, she's the NPR White House reporter, and she's great. And the reason why we wanted to share her voice is because there's a lot of talk right now about how newsrooms sound or how they should sound.
And North Korea, on the other, being confrontational. Prime Minister Abe has really invested a lot into developing a personal relationship with Trump.
Yeah, and Aisha, she just sounds like herself. I mean, I can tell she's a Black woman when I hear her voice. And that is just so damn refreshing, Leila. Especially, you know, since we've been taught, I mean, some of us have been taught to sound a certain way on the air. Like back in the day when I was training, they would actually tell us that we needed to speak in a, quote, neutral American English. That's what they called it.
You don't have to code that for me. I know what that means.
Exactly. So, like, we were trained to lose the accent, whatever accent we had, you know, losing any identifiers that some people thought would distract the listeners, right?
And it's funny you should say that, because now newsrooms are really trying to diversify voices, and they have people like Aisha on the air, but there's a lot of pushback from listeners still. I mean, some people have really made it known what they think about Aisha on the air.
Mm-hmm.
You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Henat Baba. And today we're bringing you Black on Air, an episode of the Stoop podcast hosted by me and Leela Day. We're exploring stories of Black women in journalism. Let's get back to the episode and meet an outspoken, award-winning sports journalist who's faced criticism head-on, Jemel Hill. For Jemel, she started her career in sports, right? So that meant that she was at that intersection between being one of the few women reporting in a locker room and also being one of the few Black people reporting there.
Yeah, I mean, it's an isolating place. I mean, as you know, is that when I was at the Orlando Sentinel and I was the sports columnist there, my first, you know, columnist job, and I was the only Black female sports reporter, or sports columnist, excuse me, at a daily newspaper in North America. Not America, North America. That is not something to be proud of. Not for me, it's an embarrassment and an indictment on the industry that I'm a part of. Mm-hmm. Because I'm not the smartest Black woman that ever wrote sports. Definitely, you know, I'm not the best writer, not the best reporter, you know, I'm aight, but it's just like, you know, you're not gonna convince me I'm the only person that was deserving of that job. And so automatically, just having that label, it lets you know that you're standing out, and it lets you know what you're up against at the same time. Mm. And sometimes, whether you're a man or a woman, that happens in these locker room dynamics, is sometimes one or two players that'll look out for you and help that transition less so. Because the thing is that when you walk into these environments, you're on their turf, right? This is the clubhouse. They don't like reporters in there. Look, we don't want to be there any more than they want us there. We mm-hmm. just are trying to do our jobs, and that's it. And when you come in these situations, and I'm either one of three or all three at once, where I'm either the only Black person in there, the only woman in there, or the only Black woman in there, or as I said, all three.
Yep.
And so you feel as if there's a spotlight following you everywhere you go. I'm trying to blend in, but you can't really blend in that situation. So with reps, it took me some time to kind of get over that anxiety of being in the locker room.
So Jemel became a major name in sports reporting. Then she took that leap into television.
Okay, so going from print to broadcast journalism, this is where that voice we talked about would matter.
Right. Voice and image.
A whole different world.
Yeah. Well, when Jemel made the move to television, she wasn't having it. She made it very, very clear.
I told every agent that I had, if they ever come to you and say something about my hair, I promise you that's the last day I'm going to be on air.
Mm, so she set her rules early.
Yeah, but, you know, that's Jemel. That's her personality. She asserts what she wants, and she's bold like that. But that's not easy for everyone, and she gets that.
This is the thing of how it works in television. If you have enough zeros in your contract, you can pretty much demand what you want. And I even never thought to ask it because I was super low on the totem pole with my two zeros. So they weren't gonna listen to me. And it was never a conversation for me. However, with many a Black woman in local markets, in smaller places than ESPN, it is unfortunately a conversation. And it's worse there because they don't have the leverage to really say anything. Because when you're making your way, and you have this on-air job that you need in order to get to the next step, and if the general manager or the person in charge of your show or the producer comes to you and say, we need you to change your hair, then you, in that moment, I don't judge any woman who decides to do it because you're trying to get to a place. I judge the people who ask you to do it more so than anything. So unfortunately, it is a conversation, not just for women, but for Black men too, Black men with dreadlocks. It's a huge conversation. You know, this kid once asked me, he had dreadlocks, nice, neat, well-kept, great style, handsome, looked good. He said that multiple people at his station had told him his hair was a distraction and he was wondering where to cut it. And I was like, I hate myself for telling you this, but if you're willing to walk away, that's one thing. But you know you can't afford to walk away. So for now, unfortunately, you have to cut it, if that's what they're telling you. And it was such a sickening feeling to have to tell him that, but it was the truth of what he faced. I was like, but here's what you can do. The next time you get in a position, particularly if they have put enough zeros in that contract, you grow your hair long as hell and dare them to do something about it.
You know, Lila, listening to Jamel talk like that, sadly, I mean, that is real advice for the real world. We can sit here all day and say, you be you, you do you, you know, but at the end of the day, when you're young and you're just getting in these fields, sometimes you just gotta do what you gotta do to get in and then get good at what you do, and then you get to call the shots. And it's hard to hear that sometimes.
And even though we're talking about media here, let's not forget how this plays out everywhere. I actually recently had a conversation with a friend who still won't get braids because she feels afraid that people around her and her corporate job are going to have issue with it. I mean, what year are we in? What year are we in?
Yeah, I mean, it's a shame, but it's real. And Lila, there's something else Jamel had to deal with. Speaking your mind, being assertive, you know, having opinions and voicing them in a strong way.
So, like that tweet I was talking about that Jamel Hill had fired off, and it caught a lot of attention.
So she was a reporter with ESPN, and like a lot of us, she had a lot to say about the movement where so many sports players were taking the knee. Here she is on her ESPN show SportsCenter.
So let me get this straight. Hit a woman, be accused of sexual assault, commit sexual assault. You do all those things. And they don't come out and say they don't call anybody an embarrassment. I've seen far more press conferences of GMs and owners and coaches sticking by their guys amid some pretty murky and disgusting circumstances. But that's all good. But here's somebody who's trying to stand for justice and for equality, and you consider that to be somehow embarrassing your NFL that has no problem employing some people who have done some pretty undesirable things.
And then she tweeted,
Donald Trump is a white supremacist who has largely surrounded himself with other white supremacists.
It was chaos. ESPN had a statement distancing themselves from her comment. And then the Trump administration's spokesperson at the time said it was a fireable offense. Then Jamel said she regretted that it seemed like she was speaking for ESPN. And eventually she was suspended from ESPN.
It changed my life. It changed it because, as you alluded, my profile sort of exploded. And it changed just in the type of attention that I get now that is way different than it was before. It more upset my life than anything. It didn't make me feel any kind of way about mm-hmm. what was said about me. Yeah. I didn't internalize any of that. I had to adjust to more people knowing me. I had to adjust to the fact that there are, and I mean this literally, more people who want to kill me. So I had to adjust to those things.
Yeah, but she didn't back down from the sentiment she was expressing. And although she's not at ESPN anymore, she still writes on all these topics for The Atlantic. But this got people talking about how Black women are seen when they're assertive.
The angry Black woman. When the stereotype of the angry Black woman is evoked, it characterizes Black women as irrationally angry, hyper-aggressive, verbally abusive, raucous, and argumentative.
That was from an article in The Guardian.
Yeah, it was fiery. And basically, the author, Amir Hassan Loggins, was arguing that her anger was justified. But the stereotype overtakes this justifiable anger.
It is a weapon used by character assassins looking to shoot Black women down who have the audacity to magnify social inequality, point a spotlight on uncomfortable truths, and publicly advocate for the human rights of Black women specifically.
And Jamel, you know, she emerged from that experience, but she started to get backlash, and it was real and it was scary.
I had to shut off my voicemail entirely. And I was like, you know what? I don't even need this in my life. And I just told ESPN security to dismantle it. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, just immediately when I went out in public spaces, you know, me and, you know, my husband, we went to a Monday night football game with his dad and another friend of mine, and we had to have security. So just in case, You know, the thing is, they know me, I don't know them. Mm-hmm. And, you know, with some of them saying some of the things that they had, you just never know when somebody's going to jump stupid. And it wasn't until recently that I actually read some of the snail mail that I received during that time. And it was harsh. It was some bad stuff in there. And on Facebook, I've gotten plenty of death threats and that sort of thing. So it just upsets your life in that regard, where it makes you a little more cautious about where you are publicly. And I do think the generation behind me has already gotten it so much quicker than mine did. And I think that's all most of us can be in it for. You just hope the people that behind you, that they just wind up being better than you. And so when people come up to me and say, I want to be just like you, I was like, no, you don't. You want to be better than me.
You've been listening to Black on Air, an episode of the Stoop podcast hosted by me and Leela Day. You can hear the rest of that episode at kalw.org.